Greetings, dear listener. It is me, Christian Corley, and him, James McLean. How are you? How are you, James?
Me? I'm fine.
Excellent. I should have maybe left a slightly longer pause for the listener to offer their own status update there, shouldn't I?
Status update.
Why do we call them status updates?
It's the future, isn't it?
Yeah, when I was a kid, status was sort of either what very rich people had or what was on the back of a toy to tell you like how strong he was or whatever. And now everyone has a status update.
Well, it's the tech bro generation, isn't it? As soon as tech comes in, they sort of, that sort of talk permeates language. I was reading the other day, and I'm still not sure if it's true, but a lot of websites seem to think it is.
Okay, it's probably not then.
Well, that's my feeling as well. That you remember, you might know this, in Ghostbusters, where Bill Murray, he does an ad lib, he revises a line when they're up against Gozer at the end.
Right.
And the line was, I think, we're going to make this guy toast. And he changed it to, this chick is toast. And there is an argument which seems is that that was kind of like the argument is it was the first of that sort of phrasing, using it as that sort of idiom of this person is toast.
Right.
And that seems to be everywhere. A couple of comments I've seen in Below the Line have suggested there are places earlier that did it. And again, I'm not quite sure whether it's done in the same way, because it's like, I'm going to turn them into toast. It's kind of different to this person is toast. Yeah, it sort of takes it that one step further. I don't know. It's just kind of curious, isn't it? Like where those things start. I mean, you talk about like status updates and where that you know comes from. But like, you know, that, I never thought about it. Is Bill Murray the first person to have kind of rephrased the using toast in that sort of very specific way? Your toast.
Could be.
Rather than I'm going to toast you, or toasted, but you're toast. There's a slight difference there.
There is, yeah.
I don't know. Maybe a listener knows, or maybe a listener cares. Shame on you if you do.
Yeah, this is somewhat embarrassing. So forgive me if I say this. And if I come
you're
across
on a nerd podcast. It can't be that embarrassing, relatively speaking.
All right, in the grand scheme of things. You're right, yeah. So, you know Coolio, the rapper?
Some people do, not young people, but other people. Well, yeah,
you might be aware of his work. Yeah. So when he first came out, within a week of me hearing of Coolio, I started thinking, because I thought the music was absolutely atrocious. So I subverted it intentionally by using his name as an exclamation of something crap in a sarcastic way. And now everyone says Coolio. I'm pretty sure I started that, because we're going back to like 1995. I think.
Was this Gangster's Paradise?
I think it was that, yeah.
Which wasn't really much his own anyway, since most of it was sampled.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting when you sort of see these early stages. I remember being abroad. I was abroad. God, that sounds really British colonial, doesn't it? I was abroad. I was in the States.
Oh, right. Oh, sorry. I thought you meant you were dressed as a woman. Right, I'm with you now. Okay, yeah.
No, not that point. And there was I was in California, and I remember the first time I heard someone say, saying, you know, this is sick, and that was the first time I'd heard sick used as a positive. And I was like, my God, I can't see this catching on. I can't. Will it ever cross the ocean? Because it just sounded so weird in that moment. And this was like 2003, I think.
Yeah.
It's like everything was sick, and it's like, wow, this is interesting.
My eldest says that he doesn't say it that much because it just doesn't jive with me at all. Yeah, I've just said jive, but you know, he might say it with his mates. Now he tried saying it at home a couple of times. We're like, what? Even though we know what it means or what it's supposed to mean, it just doesn't work. He's got cousins that are a couple of years older than him. They would have been like slap banging that sort of transition of that word coming over to the UK with that new meaning, but I never heard them say it. So I think it might be a boys thing more than anything else. I'm not sure.
Interesting. I don't know. Have I heard? No, maybe it is.
we've come into this with a sort of a plan of what we're going to talk about, and we're not really getting anywhere near it at the moment, are we? But a phrase is
not we going to. That's like that was a very pregnant pause, as if we had just that was it, and we're going home.
Let's go in a different direction. But no. I mean, the way language sort of develops and then appears in things, it's like years later, I am minded of a particular sci-fi TV show of a British origin.
Better not be Smeg and Red Dwarf.
No, it's not that. No, okay. It
would have been good if it had. I'd have looked pretty impressive if I got that right.
It might have been later on. We might come back to that. No, I was thinking of some of the things that Ace says.
Okay, yeah.
Like wicked.
Ace is a weird one because I've been watching. I mean, we haven't talked in a while, have we?
No, we haven't.
We haven't talked in a long time. I remember, well, more recently, since November, when they kind of put the catalogue onto iPlayer,
yeah.
I started going through them, which has made me think of another topic I wanted to use that we'll talk about after this, based on that. And so I've been going through, I did the Troughtons, kind of got into Pertwee. Well, you know, as usual, as usual for me, you guys wouldn't know this you wouldn't know this. I kind of skip most of the Pertwees because I don't particularly like the era. A few of the Bakers, because again, I know the Bakers quite well. Ended up watching the Turlough saga, oddly enough. Kind of got into Turlough and really enjoyed that. And then, skipped most of Bakers for obvious reasons as well. And I have, long story short, been looking at McCoy's and watching that. And again, This is where it gets interesting for me, because at the moment I have a tablet and I've been doodling, and now I'm putting the tablet down because obviously I've become more interested in this conversation than I was previously. So the tablet's going down, and now you're blessed with my full attention, because this is now stimulating my brain and what I've been thinking. And I know this isn't technically meant to be a Doctor Who podcast that we're doing. We're kind of going elsewhere, but Ace and McCoy and the Seventh Doctor, having watched all those runs, I've just been thinking, this is just such an incredible moment. More so than I remember when I was a kid, because that dynamic just works so well. I mean, there's a line that he has, I think it's in Ghostlight or Curse of Fenric. I think it's Ghostlight, and he turns to her and he says, "You are no use to me like this." Mm. And I just thought, you'd never get another Doctor saying that.
No.
And that was a really powerful dynamic, this real sort of tension between them. And as you said, Ace is a weird one, because at one part of me, I remember as a kid not feeling that she was very realistic. And then as I've got older, looking back and thinking, but she does actually do the things and say kind of the things we were saying back then, just minus the more colourful idioms that we'd be using. But, you know, people did kind of sometimes... I don't think people really said wicked, did they?
I think they might have done it for about 3 years in the mid-80s.
Well, that's it. I mean, you might have said, oh, God, that was wicked. I suppose you might have said that, but... Beyond that, the kind of character she was, especially when you get to Survival and you see her in Perivale with her friends, and it does feel kind of true. She wasn't that, I don't think she was that divorced from the 80s as people like to think she was.
No.
I think it's just as kids, we were just like, well, we would swear more, and she doesn't swear, so it sounds weird and childish. But
I think it's a lot of it is in the dialogue, and maybe there's a bit of the age thing as well, because you've got a 28-year-old woman playing a 16-year-old.
Yeah, I think there is a bit of that as well. But, I mean, that is a lovely dynamic they have.
Mm.
And somehow it works. And I suppose as a kid, you know, having a character called Ace was a bit weird because people didn't do that. And I don't think people still do that. If there's anyone who tries to actually give themselves some sort of positive or grandiose moniker, it dies straight away. No one buys into that shit. We don't do that. She would end up being called arse or ass. You know, she'd try Ace, but by the end of it, that's how it would have been subverted by toxic colleagues of the 80s and 90s.
It would have been arse.
Yeah, so that doesn't work, I guess. But at the same time, I suppose what I'm trying to say is, out of all the companions of all the eras, she's actually probably one of the more realistic ones.
Mm.
Tegan maybe aside. I mean, Mel was not. I mean, I've never met anyone like Mel, maybe because if I did, I wouldn't go 10 feet near them because they're incredibly irritating. But she was, she never really felt like a person. She felt like she was written and they didn't really know how to write her. I always kind of felt that was Bonnie carrying a lot of that character.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's an outline, isn't it, really? And they tried to fix that in the novels, didn't they? And in the Big Finish audio.
In the Big Finish, yeah, absolutely. But even Sarah Jane as a young character, I mean, again, Sladen's acting is really what held it together. As a character, it was kind of still following the same ley lines as the rest of them. There was no real sense of personal agency outside the Time Warrior, you know, when she was interested in the story. But Ace always kind of has some form of agency in those stories.
It's a little bit unfair. I think there's a couple of other ones. There's Robot, for example, as well. Where
But the agency is her being a journalist. It's not her as a person, really.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah. And they soften her as well, don't they?
Yes, definitely they do.
It's quite different between the first two series and the last two series.
Well, she loses the agency. She's no longer really a journalist, and so it falls upon Sladen to actually make sure that she just doesn't end up being just the archetype, the companion archetype who asks the questions, runs around, meets people.
Basically.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's ultimately the fear, isn't it, of all the companions, and I think you're actually dead on there. Vicky's probably the kind of the catalyst. She is the archetype companion, because Susan still has a connection to the Doctor, which makes her unique, and her interaction's unique. Ian and Barbara are all adults, and they have their own reasons for being there and what they're doing in the audience's bridge. But Vicky's kind of the first one who is really there to sort of be nice, ask the questions, bump into people, make friends, and just be kind of jolly. And that's what the companions will always end up being if the actor doesn't do something about it.
Yeah.
But by Ace, the writer's doing something about it. And in most of her stories, she has her own agency, which goes beyond being the foil for the Doctor. And, you know, this still continues to this day. Be it the most recent with Ruby, but be it the same, to be honest, with a lot of the main camp, you know, that they're there for the joyride. They're not there for any real internalized agency. But Ace kind of has it. And I kind of like the way that Ace also kind of adopts that space as her own. You know, she's one of the few to actually, till about, I don't know, maybe Clara. No, because they all live at home. They all in the new series, they journey occasionally with him. But she actually, it's strongly suggested that TARDIS is her home by the end of the series, by survival. You know, she gets off the cheetah planet by going home, which is not really to Earth. She pops where the TARDIS is, where the police box is. So she actually kind of is one of the first to really, and maybe one of the last as well, to find her own space. She's not doing it for a joyride. She's not doing like a hitchhiking thing where she goes back home and chats with a mum and dad and heads off. That is her home. That is her space. And that dynamic, the uncle-niece dynamic, is part of their relationship. And somehow this links back to the topic of slang and idioms, which is exactly the topic which we weren't meant to be doing from the very start. Which was meant to be the Phantom Menace, which I'm not sure how we're going to get back to the Phantom Menace or whether we need to. But
we might get to the Phantom Menace. We might not. It might be in a different podcast altogether.
Yeah.
The thing is, with language, it does like street. Let's call it street language, for want of a better term. Okay.
Yeah.
Until we come across a better term, it very rarely translates into TV language. I've found, and it might be a bit different now. The transition might be faster now with things like YouTube or whatever. But I mean, we've used the example of Doctor Who and Ace, but there's also, you do have that sort of broadcast standards, what language can you use, you know. But I mean, even at the same time, I mean, I was going to go into sort of like an example of Grange Hill, but that's very similar to the Doctor Who example, or EastEnders. But even with something like Life on Mars, which was a lot later, getting on for 20 years ago now for us at this point, but there was, and you're reflecting language of 30 years before that, even then it was kind of cartoony and inspired by the Sweeney, which itself was a watered down version of the language that was, you know, on the street What's the word on the street, Johnny? Do you know what? I haven't seen police squad in years. Anyway, that aside,
I see a lot of memes telling me to do so. I must admit, most recently, a lot of memes are there,
really?
Sort of saying, well, why is no one... Yeah, memes of police squads are saying, why did this only get 6 episodes? But anyway, yes.
That's interesting.
No, I agree. And I think that you're right, Life on Mars is interesting because it's not really based on life. It is based... It's a homage, even though they often in their interviews don't like to directly mention the Sweeney, but it clearly is massively homaged on the Sweeney, which itself is, as you say, a curated language, isn't it? It's curated to what we can use and what we can't use. But I think you're right. I think soaps are really interesting because I think things like EastEnders and Coronation Street are quite skilled at it in the sense that they often do their lack of language... lack of certain phraseologies does not stand out too much. I don't know, maybe it does. I mean, EastEnders has always felt a little thespic for me. You know, you don't tend to get people in my experience of the East End going on long monologues. It doesn't work like that. But
begging to ask you what your experience of the East End is now.
But, you know, I mean, characters in EastEnders, which are meant to be... They're portrayed as meant to be these strong working class people, will occasionally go into these quite rich, well written, sort of clearly written by someone, some Cambridge University writer, and it doesn't quite gel with when it gets to that point in not just the East End but any space with people who in a pub, they don't tend to end up going into long monologues. They tend to actually start pushing each other. So sometimes it can feel a bit artificial. The best one I found, which I'll always stand by, as I've said before, is Homicide: Life on the Street, which was the precursor to The Wire in the 90s,
right?
Which was incredibly good at giving you a sense of this East Coast Baltimore working class environment, and yet didn't use any swear words at all. And then you see The Wire, made by the same people 10 years or so later, and it is filled with the swear words. It's filled with all that, and it feels very real, but it was just odd that Homicide felt kind of real. So I think how you write it is part of it. There's probably lots of factors to it. I suppose with things like Doctor Who, you're very aware that they can't do things, that this isn't real. You are aware that it's written, when you're watching Doctor Who, you bring yourself you accept certain limitations, don't you? Which is why when you watch, say, the best Tom Baker, it's still kind of drawn out, it's got bad effects and everything, but you accept it. You'd still say it's one of the best Doctor Who episodes, despite the fact it can't live up to anything in standards of, say, Jodie Whittaker's era. So I suppose we do that as well when we watch Doctor Who, that we kind of go, yeah, it's not ever going to be able to do the things of The Wire, so we don't expect it to. So we lower our expectations of how real it'll come across. But then there's a line, isn't there, still, where something Ace might say might drop us below that line and go, Would we call that person Boghead or whatever? I don't know. Does that feel... Boghead.
So, but then, I mean, that brings to another question, which you may be the right person to ask about this or to discuss about this, which is just as well because you're the only other person in this podcast. And that is the expectations and the sort of the silent language of a format and how we interact with it and our expectations of that show based on the format and whether we've seen that format before. So you're saying the example there of Doctor Who, Tom Baker, Doctor Who, Jodie Whittaker, you have certain expectations of that show based around the not just the time format, but the way it's written and the pace of the drama and how scenes are presented. There's more to it than that, presumably, as well.
I suppose a lot of it's based on it's like a standard threshold that we'll have. So we'll live in an era and we'll compare what we have compared to everything else we have in that era. So, or roughly within that era. So we'll compare... In theory, we would compare whether a good Daleks episode in, say, Stephen Moffat's era was any good, would compare it broadly by something in another one of his era or Davis's era, but we wouldn't sort of go back to Genesis. I know some fans would, but there is a certain level of sort of like culture, you know, level of not just technological, but story crafting, story writing, which exists in different eras. And funnily enough, we find it quite charming sometimes when we watch an earlier show and we can go, that's quite, you know, and also I think it comes from an era where we are entrenched in, doesn't it? So when we watch, say, Unearthly Child, which we didn't exist in that era, we sort of, we don't judge Susan's swaying and listening to music in Unearthly Child by anything else. We can't judge it by that era because we never lived in it. We can't judge its accuracy. So maybe we're a little kinder in that sort of way. Well, things which are now, in whatever that now is, well, we're, you know, we're far. So I suppose that comes into sort of the elements of writing.
Yeah.
But then some of it is also how it shapes, isn't it? And some of it works and some of it doesn't. I mean, like Red Dwarf, I think, is an interesting one, where they get round the issues of idioms, colourful metaphors, whatever you want to call them, by creating their own. So Smeg becomes their sort of way of saying fuck. That's just, you know, that's kind of the way it works. And it sort of works there. And yet you can find, and some people might disagree, I found in the remake of Battlestar Galactica, where they started to use frack instead of fuck, didn't work. And even when they were sort of saying, you mother fracker, that would pull me out, because that was just didn't work.
Yeah.
And Farscape had similar sort of approaches as well. I think Drell and Drek or whatever. So sometimes it fits and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And maybe that, again, is depends on how close it is to words that you're familiar with. Frack is too close to fuck that you automatically, your brain connects and goes, that's not right, that doesn't sound quite right. And then that takes you out and you see the construct. While smeg doesn't sound like any swear word that we would have, so you accept it as their word and it doesn't sort of pull you out.
Didn't Fry and Laurie do a sketch based around the idea of presenting new swear words?
Yeah, I think they did.
Yeah. I'm just pointing this out there now based on the topic of this conversation and that reference there. It might be an image of Fry and Laurie accompanying this podcast. That's all I'm saying. The thing about, because what you've just said, and then you've referred to Red Dwarf, so it takes us back in the same era as well. Doctor Who with Ace and the Seventh Doctor, that show is, it got a lot of criticism at the time, and it got a lot of criticism through the 1990s, largely because it wasn't John Pertwee. Don't know what the hell that was all about. But, I mean, I have a vague idea. But contemporary speaking, at the time, there was nothing else on TV that was anything like Doctor Who. That Doctor Who had serious fast editing compared with other shows. It had a remarkable pace. It had the incidental music that carried things along. It stood out like a sore thumb, and at the time, it kind of picked up a bad press for that, when really it shouldn't have done, because I don't want to say they're exactly the same, but there is, you can go straight from Survival to Rose without stopping off at the TV movie.
Oh God, yes. I was so on with that statement that I almost knocked my headphones off. I kind of rolled in my chair. But absolutely, I funny enough, I saw my mother the other week and showed her Survival. She watched it at the time, but she hadn't seen it in years, because we've been talking about Doctor Who. And you know what Doctor Who fans do, they abuse their relatives and friends by making them watch the stuff that they really don't want to watch, but they'll watch it. The connections of Survival to Rose, the feeling of it is you incredibly feels close in sense. The one that feels out of place is the Doctor Who movie. You take that out, Survival to Rose feels almost like season, you know, that's the next season. Absolutely, I agree. And as we've said before in previous podcasts, and having rewatched them again, things like Silver Nemesis and the battle with the Cybermen, the dynamic and action in that, I don't think it had ever been seen before in Doctor Who. I can't think of a sequence directed with that sort of energy. you know, of running through this hangar, you know, shots being fired, and then these close, you know, tight shots of her in the stairwell as well, and then that you know, that great shootout, you know, on the gantry above with the three Cybermen and her with one coin. You know, that is really great stuff, which Doctor Who, I mean, yeah, other shows could do it by then and were doing it, but Doctor Who had never done. And it never really got its celebration for that. And I think part of that, as you say, comes down to the era. And, you know, without us getting political now in terms of the show, you know, the people, the McCoy era was overcast by the people who still felt the Pertwee era was the ultimate. So probably the 40-somethings who were sitting on Gallifrey 1 and the likes, who, you know, and, you know, that Pertwee era was seen as the golden era of Doctor Who. I mean, maybe some of them were, you know, retrospective people, but there was this love of Doctor Who, which was, what, 14 years prior?
Yeah.
14, 15, 16 years prior, which just shows, I think, again, and, you know, when we got to the Tennant era, suddenly McCoy's era became part of that golden age. And people were comparing Tennant's era to, you know, the golden era. I mean, obviously, a lot of people love Tennant's era, but there's always that sort of weird step. But yeah, the Doctor and Ace is fascinating because it is in itself such a unique relationship that you can almost forgive the fact that she doesn't feel quite what she's meant to be. She doesn't speak really like young people, and maybe that was the danger with her, which they'd never done before, was to try and have a young character which kind of felt like she was meant to be a young person who lived as a human being. And it just didn't quite work. And it worked better as into sort of the next two seasons, as the seasons progressed and they sort of matured her a little bit. But yeah, it's an incredible dynamic between those two, which, as I say, we've never really seen since either. But yeah,
I'm just looking at the other shows that were on in 1989 on British television. You've got the first screening of the final series of Blackadder Goes Forth. You've got Neighbours, the Kylie Minogue and Jason Donovan era, or towards the end of it. You've got the debut of Home and Away. You've got the launch of the Omnibus Coronation Street. You have the first gay kiss on EastEnders. That show was very, very slow and plodding in those days, EastEnders. There's so much that's just that's standing out as being just a very sort of typical drama that doesn't really seem to be anything.
But as we've said before, television drama had massively changed at this point. Mm. By the McCoy era, you know, there was more, certainly in my schoolyard, there was more people who were watching Coronation Street than they were watching Doctor Who. It was kind of okay for everyone to be into soaps. And sci-fi was really no longer a TV thing. It was, and in the States, aside from Star Trek, Next Generation, which had started in, what, 86, 87, essentially, and it was unusual. No other science fiction shows were really holding their own. It just didn't really, it was a genre which for television had kind of died. It was too expensive. And I think with Star Wars, had become too confusing as how to do it.
Yeah.
Because Star Wars was something that no one could really replicate without it looking like a replication of Star Wars. If you tried, it would either end up being and as we've said before, you know, a lot of the attempts afterwards were fantasy because they took, because Star Wars is largely based on lots of sort of fantasy elements to it, with the sort of Merlin-like character and the Force is essentially magic. And there was this desire from the industry to find the next Lord of the Rings for so long. A lot of the iterations of Star Wars were kind of fantasy rather than science fiction. Science fiction was just difficult. And at least with fantasy, you could use meadows and forests and stuff. Sci-fi required material you couldn't build. So I think Doctor Who's issue back at the end of the 80s was, again, especially in Britain, it was kind of a dead franchise, a dead genre.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think movies wise as well, sci-fi wasn't great in the 80s unless you were sort of Paul Verhoeven, or you were taking that angle with your sci-fi. A lot of the sci-fi movies of the 80s aren't actually that good. In the same year, you've got the network television premiere in the UK of The Search for Spock, Star Trek 3. Bit of a plodder. You've also got the original Dune movie. Again, bit of a plodder.
Well, 89 was the year of sequels as well, if we're talking about survival. So you've got Star Trek 5, you've got plodder. Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, you've got... What was that, sorry?
Star Trek 5 is a plodder.
Star Trek 5, yeah, again, wasn't considered great. You've got a lot of franchises, so you've got these established, nothing new's coming out, aside from, of course, Batman, which blew everything out of the water.
Yeah.
But there's everything else, franchise, Back to the Future 2, Young yeah. Guns 2, I think, as well. So there's a lot of these sort of sequel stuff that was, which obviously we're very used to now, was carrying the cinema sci-fi, but there was nothing particular, you know, it wasn't a genre which was really producing anything new, and for television that didn't really change until the 90s.
Yeah.
Sort of kind of like the mid-90s, where, you know, with the X-Files became big, and then you'd have Babylon 5, the Star Trek franchise split into Deep Space Nine,
but of
and
course
eventually you get Lex, Farscape, etc.
What you did get with the movies, with things like RoboCop and Total Recall, you did get realistic bad language, and also quite yeah. unrealistic bad language, in fairness. Some of it was ridiculous. But, yeah, back to the whole street language thing. So, yeah, it's...
But interesting, to be fair. I mean, even in Doctor Who these days, the street language is very tame. It has
to be.
Oh, God,
yeah.
So, and I don't really notice it, to be honest. I've never really thought about that. And, like, again, that goes back to the things you say. Is it something that we just kind of accept because of the format? And so our brains don't look for it, so our brains don't find it unrealistic that it's not there.
Mm. Yes.
And I suppose just going back to that point with sci-fi in the 80s, the only time travel sci-fi show at the back end of the 80s which was working was Quantum Leap,
yep.
and that was stateside. And it was doing everything which Doctor Who was at the time, and still is, trying not to do, which was to do stories about drama set in different time periods where there wasn't a big monster or a big you know, megalomaniac to defeat, which Doctor Who was, you know, had been doing since the late 60s. So again, Doctor Who was kind of out of its space. The only time travel show which was kind of working was a time travel show which was literally about time travel and was not about sci-fi monsters. It was a format which played more for melodrama than it did for its sci-fi agency.
Yeah.
Which again, I mean, it's fits basically, the sort of things you'd be saying.
It's the what's that show called? Stairway to Heaven.
Oh yeah,
it's basically that, isn't it? Really?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
A little bit of Randall Hopkirk deceased, maybe as well, but. Mm. It's a period where dramas are kind of, you know, as you say, it's kind of the era of the melodrama, because essentially soap operas are. And they were, the Dallas and the Dynasties were still big, you know, Bold and the Beautiful, or whatever it was called, stateside. And over here we had this big soap resurgence. And even when you had sci-fi, Star Trek Next Generation, its first two seasons were inherently drama based. They were not about the sci-fi. They were about dynamics and issues between people, and amping that up into, you know, that was that sort of period. And yeah, Doctor Who wasn't doing that. And yet at the same time, Doctor Who was trying to do it a little. As I say, Cartmel's era, you are starting to get sort of direct questions about, nothing massively direct, but, you know, there's, you know, Remembrance of the Daleks is the racial element,
yep.
the racism. You've got issues of maternal crisis, of Ace's issues with her mother, which again no other companion had at the before that, and trying to reconcile that, you know, a person trying to grow up. There's a lot of sort of little minor things going on there which kind of reflected what drama was doing elsewhere, but Doctor Who just wasn't really,
hadn't.
Wasn't even like it,
yeah.
hadn't, yeah, no, it hadn't done it, and it was only starting to try it. Yeah, and the movie doesn't either in 96. It's not until Rose that we start to see a little more of that come again with this proper working class family.
The TV movie.
I know a lot of you have a love for the team. I know you do.
It's got a lot wrong with it. Don't get me wrong. It's in many ways, this is a different podcast. It's in many ways a shopping list, isn't it? So it has certain things that it has to achieve, and it's sacrifices.
Maybe that's a commentary podcast for the future.
Maybe it is. We can get Brian on for it.
Yeah, Brian loves that, doesn't he?
Yeah. Are we going to wrap this up?
I was just wondering about the Phantom Menace.
I think that's going to be after we've had a short break.
Are you sure? I think the Phantom Menace could be quite good to just try and tack on the end here. I like the idea that we've taken this really long trek to the actual, and I love the idea of someone actually listening to this podcast for the first time, thinking it'd be on the Phantom Menace, and then having to wait 40 minutes before it's even mentioned.
No, we're not doing that. That's just too subversive.
I mean, does Star Wars have any... I suppose it does now. There are certain phraseologies, isn't there, that's unique? I'm sure there are.
Well, I have a bad feeling about this.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a bad feeling about
this. It's probably something
along
the lines of, Jesus Christ, I don't want to do this, or something like that.
But I'm sure more recently there are actual words. There are... I'm just trying to think what they might be. But it is essentially quite a clean universe in terms of... They never did that, did they?
It is a clean universe. You know, you're onto the Death Star. Everything's shiny clean, isn't it? Those space fascists know how to keep a ship clean. You say a lot for them. They know how to clean up after themselves.
Especially black, because black marks really easily. And it's quite hard. You have to polish it quite a lot to actually keep that clean.
There must be some polisher droids. Maybe that's what those toasters are doing. Maybe that's what their job is.
It's funny how that was a world where it did its world building not in its dialogue, but in its aesthetic, in its visuals.
And
they became very specific, even in those first three films. But the actual, as you say, the sort of like the idioms, there's none of that sort of... I mean, I suppose their guns are called blasters. I suppose that is a little bit of a world building thing in terms of you've got lightsabers and, but ultimately there's not like a lot of sci-fi we'd often try and do or often tries to do is try and build its own language. I suppose hyperdrive is about as far as you get, but there was no sense of that sort of. But then did they do that in sci-fi around that time?
No, not really, no.
I mean, because even the
unless it's
Star
something
Trek
that's already
really.
Grounded on Earth, there's not much. I mean, even Aliens starts off on Earth or on an Earth base before they go anywhere, and you already have an idea of the sense that there is an economy and there's a company involved. You get that through the dialogue in the first Alien movie as well, so that comes across, that follows through. With RoboCop, you're set on Earth, the strike, so you already know that there's an economic problem. Total Recall, similar.
Blade Runner does have a sense of trying to build, while it's not new language, but fusing language.
It's one
of the first ones where it tries this sort of mix of,
I assume
it's sort of Mandarin, and so that. And again, you see a little bit, you see it quite heavily done in Firefly, Joss Whedon's series in the 2000s. But that again is pulling from your conventional understanding of Blade Runner, where it was doing that same sort of thing, and a lot of its vernacular coming from the Western. So it's drawing from two spaces which you already feel comfortable with, that when they're in that mix don't feel so alien that you feel it's false. Because I suppose that's the thing, isn't it? It's how do you make it feel alien and not but yet relatable, which is why I think Star Wars did very well, is it did manage to sort of fuse in the visual aesthetics of even where it was a galaxy far, far away. It could have been humans, Americans essentially, and British people in space.
Well, it's pretty wholesome, isn't it, really, Star Wars?
Yeah. But then you've got things like, I mean, the X-Wing fighters are heavily based on biplanes. You know, there's a lot of playing around with Millennium Falcon, the bomber, you know. Sort of naval vessels in the sense of the sort of way that the Empire works. It's all very, very familiar, but at the same time done in a way which feels enough alien that it doesn't sort of make you look for that tension between the two. So I suppose that's part of where Star Wars' successes was, in that in that ability. And I think a lot of that was Camden Market, I think, as well, buying props from weird spaces in London to sort of make this world feel quite quirky. But it was very clever like that. Even lightsabers, which, as we know, were made from bits of cameras, yeah, of camera flashes, again, gave you a sense of something which had a mechanical sense, even though it didn't, because it was built around something which was actually part of a mechanism.
I used to have a beautiful, beautiful book. I can't remember the name of it now. It had sort of like a black and gold front cover with a line drawing of Darth Vader's helmet. And it was full of Ralph McQuarrie's concepts. And so you've got the hamburger for the Millennium Falcon, that idea. You've got also the kind of the street light lamp for Slave One as its inspiration. Yeah. So, yeah, there's a whole load of things that have just been drawn from real life that have then been developed into, as you're saying, props and equipment and ships in Star Wars. And also the other thing, just drawing back on what you're saying about the naval vessels and everything, the Star Destroyers and the Millennium Falcon as well, and most of the other craft, they, when they built the original models, they used them bashed up airfix kits, didn't they, of ships and aircraft for the detail.
So it gives you that sense of something you can connect to realistically. Mm. So, I mean, because I think if the X-Wing fighters had looked like flying saucers or rocket ships, Flash Gordon's rocket ships, you know, it wouldn't sit, it wouldn't communicate. But, I mean, again, it's all those things, it's about like semiotics and like, isn't it? It's just, you've got the whole idea that, you know, we see the X-Wing fighter, our brain sees kind of like a biplane, you know, a warplane, doesn't it? If it was a shape of a flying saucer, we wouldn't see warplane, we would see futuristic spaceship or rocket, we'd see rocket ship. Mm. But you want to sort of say these are ships, spaceships, which fight very much like in World War II.
Yeah.
So we make them like things you would imagine a World War II film. I think that was obviously its cleverness, was the way that it kind of matched everything to things that we would relate to, in a way that made it relatable and yet still exotic. Even things like the land speeders, you know, they're still very much a car, just with our wheels, but not. And again, making them feel dirty and used, I think that was the key thing as well, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Which even goes back to Star Trek. I remember Shatner used to say that him and Nimoy were very keen when they used those communicators initially, that they didn't use them very delicately as one would want to, because it's a prop, that you would flick them open as if they were very utilitarian, they were just part of your equipment.
Yeah.
And I think that was something that was starting to happen in science fiction in that period, was that sense of, you know, how do we make it feel used and real? And Star Wars, I think, succeeded on that.
Well, I think, we obviously need to tie things up a little bit. If we just refer back to Doctor Who in terms of the familiar, you have the police box, which at the time of Doctor Who's birth, even then, was kind of not that familiar, because I don't think they were using them an awful lot in the 1960s at that point.
No, they weren't particularly.
But people knew what they were.
Yeah, they were still present, I think, till the end. I think the walkie-talkie started coming sort of back end. I'm sure someone can actually be more specific than that, because that's obviously what made them redundant.
Yeah.
What blows me with police boxes is that they would, as people who listen to this podcast probably know anyway, that the police box would be linked to the local stations. So if there was a need for a bobby, the light on the police box would flash. So a passing bobby would be able to see, passing policeman would be able to see, and then go into the police box and call the station. Mm-hmm. And just think just how poor of a system of communication that is, that you'd have to be on the streets where the police box is. But then I suppose you'd have to say that just shows how many police boxes would probably be around. But that's why you'd have the flashing light to alert them that there was a call for them.
Or indeed how much crime there was.
Well, yeah, I mean, I doubt that would be used very often at all. Or maybe it would be, I don't know. I mean, again, it'd be fascinating to actually speak to someone who actually knows about this. I mean, I never realised until recently, I mean, I was aware that the old Metropolitan ones were concrete, but obviously the doors were wood.
Yeah.
And that's always a weird thing, because, you know, again, having not it's a funny world, isn't it, where we talk about this thing that I've come across and seen, but I've never really, you know, never actually seen them in the space as they were, because it was before my time. And their use and their sort of physicality is kind of lost to this silly science fiction show.
Where they're usually made of wood or fiberglass.
Exactly, made of wood or fiberglass, or certainly painted to look like they're wood.
Yeah.
And referred to as wood most of the time as well.
Yeah.
And they're not even the same shape, which, you know, again, I still find crazy that we don't try and, you know, as I've said many times before, if we were going to do a historical drama and do a phone box from the 40s, it would look like a phone box from the 40s. We wouldn't just make it up. But again, I suppose that just shows how much that image has not become a propriety of the police box. Propriety, but has become kind of part of the cultural mindset that we don't feel like we need to have something accurate, as long as it looks, it's blue, it looks wood, and it's got those window frames, it's a police box. And the fact that we consider it wood, because Doctor Who's told us it's wood. And it's like, well, hang on, no, it'd have been concrete. In fact, if we look at that very first prop back in the pilot, it was painted to have a concrete sort of sense to it. It wasn't painted to look like it was wood.
Yeah.
I don't know. Phantom Menace, it's a funny film, that.
It is, isn't it? Thank you, everyone, for joining us on this Castorbris edition. We will be back with another chat soon. It might even be about The Phantom Menace. Who knows? Until then, it's goodbye from us.